I think we'll start and get on Kit Nagel. And yesterday we were talking, did the Cliff Notes version of 1,000 years of Chinese history. And today we're going to talk about really the evolving role or position of the United States in the world and the changes. I guess I should say we're starting now. Sorry for the tape. Changes in the global reality. And a couple pieces just to give some context to that. There's the term globalization. And it's been an abused word, but it's still a valid word. You know, some people say globaloney and all this, but globalization is a reality. And an amazing statistic is that almost 31% of the world's output of goods and services crosses a national border. That is an incredible statistic. It can't be true, but it's true. And as in the swing toward greater integration of cultures, greater integration of markets, this is 10 percentage points from where it was in the mid-90s. Think of the growth rate. And double what it was in the pre-globalization days of the mid-1970s. Remember, we talked about 1978 was a time when China really drove its market economy and re-engaged in the world. So we are double what we were really a fairly recent time ago as far as the percentage of goods and services that travel around the world. And I never would have anticipated this this level of fly path as well. The term behind me is BRIC, and it's anyone know the acronym?
Brazil, Russia, India, China.
Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Very good. The United States is a dominant world economy. It's not going away. It's not going to go quietly into the night. But it is not where the growth is going to be. Our economy is massive, and it will continue to do well. But if you're going to be in business, or you're going to be part of the action where the world is expanding, where the growth rates are going to happen, where the opportunities for business, you will have a role in the BRIC. And that's a term international business folk use, international financiers use, the people at the UN use, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And we'll come back to that very much this morning. Current era, where we are with the United States, really, we can only call it by one name, and that's sort of unipolar, a unipolar world, an age where there is only one global power, one superpower. And that is, of course, the United States, and that position is unprecedented in our experience, unprecedented in history. And American dominance is not simply military. We have time, we can get to that at the end. But the U.S. economy is as large as the next three economies combined, and that is Germany, Japan, and Britain. Actually, Japan is number two. That's sizable. And it is more, if we think about our own culture, we think about our own society, we are more dynamic economically. We are more youthful demographically. If you think of the aging societies in Europe, a huge issue now in Japan, very much an aging society. We are more flexible culturally than really any other part of the world. And so here we are. But what worries people around the world is living in a world that is shaped and dominated one by one country, the United States. And here we are, 5% of the world's population. And yet we have this remarkable dominant role. We are part of what's known by economists and development folk as the triad. Anybody know the expression, the triad? You did real well on the BRIC. Okay.
You're going to talk about BRAC later.
The triad is the three. It's comprised of Western Europe, North America, and Japan. And those are really the advanced economies of the world, the triad, the dominant economies. And collectively, the triad is 15% of the world's population and 70% of the world's income. The world's 60% poorest account for, I'll say this again, the world's 60% of the world's poorest account for 6% of the world's income. So there is, you know, we talk about all kinds of divides, even though there's been great development. The world, there are much fewer desperately poor people than there were in China. I mean, hundreds of millions have moved out of abject poverty in India. Hundreds of millions have moved out of abject poverty in China. And yet, there is this tremendous divide. Also, the viewing of the position of the United States in the world has evolved over time. And I'd like to take just a brief quote from Zbigniew Brzezinski, you know, was former security advisor with Carter. And he talked about the months before the American invasion of Iraq. And he, along with Brent Scowcroft, also former national security advisor for George Herbert Walker Bush, and they both spoke out very strongly against the Iraq war and the dangers of going to war unilaterally against Saddam Hussein. And they warned presciently, I like that word, as it turns out, of the dire consequences of doing so unilaterally and without a larger strategic plan. Boys and girls in Washington went into Iraq unilaterally without a strategic plan. There was no doubt that the U.S. military could take down the Iraqi military in 8 days. Then what the hell do you do? Okay? And they winged it. Okay. And it's not that America doesn't have a few grown-ups. Colin Powell, you know, Gulf War I, people are saying, why didn't you go, you know, go north after Kuwait? Why didn't you go north into Baghdad? And if you remember, Colin Powell said, if you break it, you own it. And there was an interesting interview with James Baker, former Secretary of State under George Herbert Walker Bush. And the talking heads after Gulf War I, the commentariat in our society, were very critical and saying, look, you had this opportunity. You had defeated the army of Iraq. Why didn't you go and actually just depose this noxious person? So really, Gulf War I was a failure, wasn't it, Mr. Baker? And Baker says today that they don't ask him that anymore. Brzezinski talks about how things have changed in the world really since the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the subsequent collapse of the Soviet Union. At that point, America was globally admired, faced no peer, no rival, no threat. And so in 20 years, what happened? Now the United States is widely viewed around the world with intense hostility, not on an individual basis, but on a government-to-government basis. Its credibility, our credibility, is in tatters. Our military is bogged down in the Middle East. Our allies distancing themselves. There's really a lot to worry about. We've got a falling dollar. We've got the subprime disaster. And for those of you that are here next week, there's an economist, John Wallace, and he and I may do a three-part Harmony Forum on the subprime. And rampant anti-Americanism resulting from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that's actually going to take years to run their course. So that's one perspective on where we are. And we are what Fareed Zakaria, one of the best commentators we have on global issues, talks about it in the post-American world. Remember, the 20th century was the American century. We're now in a post-American world. America will remain the sort of this politico-military superpower, but really in many other dimensions, industrial, financial, educational, social, cultural, the distribution of power is shifting, and it's moving away from American dominance. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's messy, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. One of the themes I want to lay out and from this session is to think about where we were and where we are. And last night we we talked about the isolationist tradition and tendencies within China. And if you think back over the last 50, 60 years after World War II, and you think back to the BRIC, okay, don't worry about Brazil that much, but think back to the BRIC, okay. After World War II, China under Mao was isolationist, okay, largest population on the planet, isolationist. Where was India? India was following an inward-looking, bureaucratic, socialist model of self-reliance. They were still sort of getting the chip off their shoulder after the British Raj, and they, by God, were going to do it themselves, and they looked inward. They were not engaged with the world. And the Soviet Union chose the now debunked road of state-controlled command economy. Okay, so there we got three of the four in the BRIC not being engaged with the world. I think that's hugely important. And so basically these societies, these cultures, took themselves out of the game. They took themselves out of the international arena and the world economy. U.S. industry became dominant by default. And we thought we were all so smart. A bunch of other people just weren't on the field. They weren't on the game. Just an interesting aside on the Soviet Union. In the early 90s, I was part of a group of was put together by the government in Russia and the U.S. government to go over and help, quote unquote, sort of fix their economy. And the Russians were expecting that we were going to come over and sprinkle magic technology dust and fix their economy. And one of the things that I found amazing in looking at the command economy, you know, it's when you have these five-year plans, is where everything is centrally mandated, centrally controlled. And so the Politburo would say, okay, in the next 5 years, we're going to produce so many tons of coal. We're going to produce so many tons of wheat in Ukraine. We're going to produce so many tons of steel. And so that everything was fair and balanced, everything got measured in tons. So when it came to industrial production and making tractors, they said, well, you need to produce 300,000 tons of tractors. Okay. And you will be measured and paid and rewarded based upon you meeting your quota for tonnage of tractors. So what any rational plant manager is going to do is going to meet quota and make very heavy tractors. So Soviet Union produced tractors that weighed 18 and 19 tons. Okay. Now what happens when you, Russia has a lot of mud, right? When you put an 18 or 20 ton anything in mud, what happens? It goes down and stays in the mud. And so you have this command economy, incredibly stupidly inefficient. I don't know if that's good English. But the plant manager gets a little pin, the Order of Lenin, right? He or she did her job, and yet some reason Russia had real problems feeding itself because it couldn't get efficient on its farms because the tractors wouldn't work.
That's an amazing story.
Okay. And you say, well, that's Anyway, so these now are moving away, you know, these disengaged. Now, Russia, for all its problems with its oligarchs and whatever, is re-engaging with the world. Brazil is going great guns in the Americas. We have India and we have China re-engaged. So with these major powers now very much a part of the world economy, the landscape has changed. With the rise of China and India and other emerging markets, this economic growth has swept the globe, and a globe that is becoming increasingly decentralized and yet increasingly interconnected. And we definitely are moving into a post-American world, one that's defined and directed from many places and by many pieces. This Fareed Zakaria wrote a book, it's just out, The Post-American World. It's brilliant, fall down brilliant. And he talks about there's been three major power shifts in the last 500 years, okay? And this ties in nicely with last night. In 500 years ago, China did what? China took itself out of the game. China became isolationist. So in the last 500 years, while the dragon slept, what happened? Well, the first great power shift was in Europe, the rise of the West, the rise of Europe, which produced really modernity as we know it in science, technology, commerce, capitalism, great agricultural efficiency, and of course the Industrial Revolution. The second of the three was the rise of the U.S. in the 20th century. And then the third now, in this century, Zakaria calls the rise of the rest, with China and Russia obviously becoming major players in their regions and beyond, Russia becoming much more aggressive, Brazil being a huge player on the world scene as in the commodity markets, in the food markets, and now they have discovered huge offshore oil reserves. So they're going to be in great shape. And there's a tremendous rapport and relationship now in trade between Brazil and China. It's interesting that the rest, the rise of the rest, is that it is largely a result of, I'm not being arrogant here, but of sort of American ideas and actions. So for the past 60 years since World War II, our politicians and diplomats have been encouraging countries to open their markets, to free up their politics, to embrace trade relationships, embrace modern technology. We've urged countries to take up the challenge of competing in the global economy. Competition breeds efficiency. It's not always easy, but competition, obviously the tractor makers in Soviet Union didn't have any competition. I don't think they'd have lasted till Thursday against John Deere. Okay. Freeing up of currencies, again, that generally is a good thing. Countries manipulate their currencies to some degree, and developing new industries. And we don't have time to go into it here, but this is all part of economics, of trade theory of comparative advantage. You specialize in what you do well, and you trade the surplus to another country, and you import what they do well with their surplus. And it is a truth that globalization, that trade, everybody benefits. And we can argue hugely, but that is a truth. Now, some benefit greater than others. The world is not fair, but in the main, everybody benefits. And I don't think that we should begrudge the 280 million Indians that now have a decent standard of living, or the 350 million Chinese that are now out of abject poverty that now have a decent standard of living. And that is a result of trade theory of comparative advantage. Now, that we're not always going to win in that, But generally, I don't think we as a culture should begrudge the rise or legitimate aspirations of people coming out of poverty, whether it's in Asia or sub-Saharan Africa. We counseled many people to embrace change and embrace market economies. And Fareed Zakaria says it worked. The natives have gotten good at capitalism. And they have. And the interesting irony in that one finds here, I'm kind of taking off from where Zakaria stopped, but the interesting irony here is that with the rise of the rest, America is becoming suspicious of the very things that we've long celebrated: free markets, trade, freedom of travel, immigration, technological change, and democratic primaries. Democrats trashed Clinton's NAFTA. Okay, Republicans called for tighter immigration. Really kind of away from where much of America or our tradition. Where we are, though, or we should be concerned about, is American students are falling behind students in other developed countries in science and math, and that's a real, we should worry. We should worry about that. We should look perhaps for another role for the United States in the world, a role in which the world is rapidly shifting from the sort of unipolar reality to one that is going to be messier and more dynamic. And we can serve a beneficial role as a global broker. We can help forge relationships with other countries, and we can change our position of issuing directives, being unilateral to other countries. Here we are, the superpower. This is what you should be doing. If you're not with us, you're against us. Sound familiar? Where we have succeeded is where we have acted in concert with other countries, not where we have stood alone. And there is resentment, justifiable resentment, against the folks in the administration because of this. Interestingly, we need to think about consultation with others. What a concept. Cooperation and even compromise. And it's very refreshing that this verbiage is used by both McCain and Obama. Compromise. It's not, but they are both grown-ups. And I'll leave that alone. So, in short, if we can end the sort of unilateral cowboy stuff that's done, have been done by the Bush administration, I think that would be a good thing. Also, then, I want to pull back to last night and a central challenge, not necessarily a bad challenge, but a central challenge for us in American diplomacy is going to be China. How to deter its aggression, deter its darker angels in Tibet and other places, and deter its expansionism. And while at the same time accommodating its legitimate growth. What China elects to do, we may not like it, but it's a sovereign state, and it can design its society and its economy as it wishes. If we are seen as too overbearing, as too military-minded, China will likely position itself as the alternative to a bellicose, an arrogant America, and it will accelerate its expanded economic ties and enlarging the sphere of influence with other countries. Now that's ongoing, but it then we don't want it to move into us and them camps. If this does move into sort of a new Cold War, and it will be a huge challenge for us, because we will not be competing with a vibrant market. We will be competing with a vibrant market economy, with a market society, with the world's largest population, and a nation unlike, well, a nation that's not showcasing a hopeless model of state socialism like Soviet Union did, or squandering its power in pointless military interventions overseas like the Soviets did, you know, in Angola and other places. So this is a new challenge for the United States, one we have not tackled before and for which we are not at all prepared. The issue then is the rise of China, trailed by India. China's economy is the most incredible success story in history. Almost 30 years of growth in the 7 to 10% range. China today, remember last night, was, you know, 1978 is one of those key dates in Chinese history when it really opened up and engaged, decided to engage with the world. And today, China exports more in one day today than it exported in all of 1978. Think about gearing up to do such a thing. It's amazing. So this authoritarian modernization just hums along. China operates on so large a scale that it can't help changing really the nature of the game. And we all see their influence on the world commodity markets. And everybody talks about oil, but it's not just oil. It's nickel, it's steel, it's zinc, it's aluminum. And relevant for us is copper. Looked it up, and in 2002, the price of copper was 70 cents a pound. Today, the price of copper is $3.22 a pound. I think we should get together and decide whether we're going to reopen the mine. But we're, again, we have to put this in context that China, and again, it's very difficult to compare apples and apples here, but the size of the Chinese economy is around $3 trillion in US dollar terms. The American economy is $14 trillion. So hugely important, but in context, the United States still has such a strong role. So there's economic issues. Then let's talk a little bit about education. Well, let's go back actually to the economic pieces. Hadn't finished up there. We need to look at the America's role and a changing role in there are various cultural strengths that are not captured in the media, that are not captured by statistics or growth rates or export surpluses, and our media parrots news releases, often alarmist, about our decline and how we're being supplanted by so many other countries. One of the statistics that's bandied around is that China produces 600,000 engineers a year, and India produces 350,000 engineers a year, and the United States only produces 70,000 per year. Okay, that's true, and it's also not true. If you, in the Asian numbers, are included auto mechanics, industrial repairmen, HVAC folk, but not four-year credentialed engineers. If you back out those from the Asian numbers, America actually trains more engineers per capita than China or India. So there was a, I'm sort of British, or a little bit of me is British, and there was a 1800s, there was a prime minister called Disraeli, and he said there were three kinds of lies. And he said, there are lies, there are damn lies, and there are statistics. So whenever you hear doom and gloom, especially from the talking heads, don't believe it. Okay, getting back to where I was going with higher education. Higher education is one of America's best industries, and we can be high-minded and about academia, but it is an industry. And depending on how you count, 40 to 60% of the world's top 50 universities are in the United States. We worry about the offshoring of technology, especially with IT, to India. That's very real. We all know about Bangalore. But India graduates between 35 and 50 PhDs in computer science each year. In America, the figure is over 1,000. Again, those are the kind of statistics our media, it's not interesting because it's not worrisome. Okay. I'd like to kind of end this piece and then look for comments, or I could talk about the military perhaps a bit. But American cultural strengths, we actually have them. And there's openness. We're an open society. It's a great strength. We are able to innovate. We actually manage things real well. We build ports and airports and planes really well. Caterpillar, you know, earth-moving equipment, par excellence. We do things really well. We innovate. We recognize opportunity. And one of our cultural strengths is competition. We are risk takers, and if you fail, that's okay in America. You get to try again. In other cultures, you fail, you don't get to try again. One thought that has struck me is one of my colleagues at Concordia is a management professor from Poland. He's a character, Andrzej Wlodarczyk, and he grew up in communist Poland. And he has tremendous faith from his perspective in the United States. And what he sees as America's abiding strength is a legitimate legal system. Now, none of us like lawyers. Okay. But what that does, and we have a lot of lawyers, we have more lawyers per capita than anybody in the world. And Obama's right when he says that, you know, we should produce less lawyers and more engineers. But what that gives us is a legitimate legal system, and what does that do? That limits official corruption, okay? And it gives freedom in entrepreneurial opportunity so people can have the benefits of their risks. And they produce something, they can have a copyright on what they write on the code that, you know, electronic code that they write. And this legal system and empowering of the, which is connected, the empowering of this risk-taking of entrepreneurial-ness in America is something we just flat out take for granted. And this is not the norm internationally. And it's very interesting to hear in that focused point of someone who grew up in communist Poland, where everything is corrupt, everything is corrupt, and that's part of that culture. And it actually, when Andre came to the United States, it took him 3 or 4 years that you could actually succeed in a society by being honest. We tend to think, we hope that's our starting off point. And that is a tremendous success. America, I believe, will remain the default power. Others may fear us, but who else right now is going to facilitate or take care of much of the global business? And we're a relatively liberal society, and maybe it takes a liberal seafaring empire to temper the powers of other countries, and in everyone's sort of Adam Smith enlightened self-interest, the world may become a better place. So there's this evolution of the role of the United States, and hopefully with new change in Washington, well, it's so bad it can only get better, and that the role of the United States will mature. Sure.
I have a question. You talked about the fear-mongering of the media, and it causes so much anxiety among masses of Americans, and I think that's incredibly regressive upon our society, and instead of hope and progression, we've had regression for a while now, and it seems it's... Do you see how that, I mean, people seem to be somehow overcoming it, but it's very difficult. Can you address that a little more?
That's a very good comment. I don't know that I can address it. It's a reality that there is a dumbing down in our media. You see reports where, you know, the Washington Post is firing 300 of their 900 reporters. I don't have an answer. It's a great comment. I don't have an answer. Yes.
Last month, my son and I were spent the week down at the ELCA's Immersion Center in Mexico City, and heard the exact opposite from what you just said in terms of globalization. We went down there very naive, and now I still try to balance these things out. I'll parrot what I would say is the argument I've heard back from them, knowing that I'm not an economist. But they would say, go back to that 60% of the population having 6%, that's only a measurement of money. And that if a farmer is living on their own land with their own community surrounding them, providing maybe not top-flight medicine, but living in a community that has traditions and things to help out. They're using localized grains that have been developed over centuries by farmers before them, that they have a sustainable living, but they don't help the global economy because they don't consume. And so with NAFTA coming in, what's happened is it's pushed people off that land. Big companies have taken over. I saw in a video, a man said, hey, I live here on the hillside, try to feed my family off this lousy land that I'm forced to live in, where down in the valley, they're raising cattle for dog food in America. So the NAFTA, they're really upset, and they claim that what's happened is, maybe if you look in dollars, yeah, more people have more money, but they're now living in slums outside of Mexico City. And they have no community, they have a broken healthcare system, and their big argument is that when NAFTA happened, you had a big player like the United States competing with a player with a broken tax system, a broken legal system, and so it was ripe for the picking. We complain about small farmers being wiped out in America because NAFTA. They say that's 70% of the population in Mexico, and that there should be protections for grains and things like that. And that's what leads to people sweeping over the border, desperately trying to find a place where they can survive. But that's the argument that was given to me.
And that's an informed argument, and there one has to kind of wend one way through. You can tie this, you know, there have been food riots, you know, in Mexico and in Haiti and countries of Asia as part of, you know, the shortage of food production. And there are many, the world is a very complicated place. And you look at our own use of corn in this country. And I don't want to spent too much time on this, but it was at one time in with Ford and Carter and mostly and Reagan too, was that conversion to ethanol from corn, the politicians followed the science, okay? And then, and this applies to both major parties, the Arthur Daniel Midland, and, you know, was very supportive of lots of folk, and guess what? Lots of things happened where there was government subsidies that took corn out of our food chain system. And Arthur Daniels is very, very happy with that. And when the price of any food grain goes up, replacement food grains of other kinds of grain, whether it's rice or wheat, will also go up. So it's a hugely complicated issue. But from what, and economies are messy, and the world, to quote Jimmy Carter, is not fair. But the hundreds of millions that are living better today than they were in 1978 is also a reality. And
that's actual daily living, not just dollars.
That's purchase power parity. That's looking what is it with their income, how many ribbon B do I spend to buy an egg? Not how many dollars do I spend to buy
an egg. How many eggs do I actually have in my plate? Right. If I was raising our chickens and wasn't purchasing. Right.
So this is actual income in local currency that buys local stuff. It's not comparing dollars to not across dollars. Yeah.
What's the role of the confidence of the rest of the world and the stability of our currency? How does that play out in terms of our continued position as the dominant economic position in the world?
That's a very deep question. And if you're going to be here next week, there's John Wallace, who is a lead economist at University of Maryland. There's sort of a nationalistic or jingoistic thing to say, well, you know, we believe in a strong currency. Well, strong currencies, the strength of a currency is relative to, you know, it's a zero-sum game. One goes up, one goes down. The dollar, you know, is about 146, 148 against the euro today. 12 years ago, it was about 86 cents, 86 U.S. dollars could buy a euro. It has to do with many sort of macroeconomic issues, and there are winners and losers. For exporters, let's say Caterpillar or Boeing, a weak dollar is a wonderful thing. Why? Because Boeing knocks the socks off of Airbus. Okay, that's jobs, that's employment, that's a humming area of, I mean, there are big parts of our economy that are really in really good shape because of a weak dollar. Additionally, it comes a question, what is an American company? The majority of Coca-Cola's profits, the majority of Pepsi's, the majority of General Electric's revenues are international revenues, okay? We are globally engaged, and so if you think about it, if you're getting revenue now, you know, in yen or in pound sterling or in euros, okay, you're selling in euros, and then you're converting those euros back into dollars, okay, and the euro appreciated 40%, you're getting back 40% more dollars than you were last Thursday. So for American major industries, a number of them very, very healthy, and then follows on. Who owns those industries? Pension funds, you and me. So it's a very good question of, you know, what is the longer term impact of a weak dollar? And I'll defer to, I'm not an economist, so I'll defer to an economist on that. The shorter term trade picture is interesting. Okay, Stephen?
At the risk of trying to connect some dots here,
and bring it home to those of us that call ourselves followers of Jesus. Can you speak to, as you see this new postmodern, post-American world emerging, and we're in it, what questions and challenges does that pose for those of us who claim to follow Jesus, the Christian church, or whatever? That kind of question, I'm interested.
It's a very good question. I will talk Friday on foreign aid and the effectiveness of foreign aid. I think also as a society, I don't have much time. I would talk briefly about the allocation that we give to our military in the United States, about what we what should be the use and role of our military. And in the balancing of expenses of the federal government for national security, you know, is defense, diplomacy, and development. And we'll be talking about that Friday. Just a couple comments. I'll come around to your question, but a couple comments on the use of our, the use or misuse of our military. Our military is a phenomenal thing. It has tremendous propensity for good. It has this amazing lift capacity. So when there are terrible earthquakes in Pakistan, we can provide aid. It is not always evil. It can be used for good. There was a chap I met who is a professor, Ingvar Reik, at the University of Estonia. And he talked about the United States providing relief after the great tsunami. And he wrote, when the tsunami struck, the USS Abraham Lincoln and its carrier group had been flying thousands of rescue missions for a week before the European Union organized a committee to arrange a 3-minute silence. So there's a great capability that can be used for good. It was, you can draw your own message for whether it was used for good or not in Iraq. It can be used for good, and also sometimes the non-use is a bad thing. And I'd kind of like to end on this. We don't have a lot of time, but this, it was not used to prevent genocide in Rwanda. Okay. And a few years back, I mentioned him last night, but he was on our campus, the late Senator Paul Simon, he spoke and about the role of the U.S. And in the early 90s, he chaired a Senate subcommittee on Africa. Paul Simon was a smart fellow. And in April and May of 1994, there were these early tremors from Rwanda. Senator Simon and Senator Jim Jeffords, who was the ranking Republican on that committee from Vermont, got a call from a Canadian General Dallaire on the ground in Kigali and said, you know, there's some bad stuff cooking here. And he had 250 UN troops. Okay. The Blue Hats are not that credible a force. And he said, this is this general, Canadian general for the UN, if he could get 5,000 to 8,000 troops quickly, he could stop the killing. You know, the 82nd Airborne is on standby. They could be there in 2 days. They flat out could. He could nip this thing in the bud. And that afternoon, Jeffords and Simon had messages hand-delivered to the State Department and to the Clinton White House saying, let's focus here. There's something boiling. Let's move quickly. Let's do something proactive and save human lives. They waited a day. They waited 2 days. Nothing happened. 10 days later, Simon called the White House and was told by one of the political operatives that a political judgment had been made that there just wasn't a base of support, and the polls would not support a public support for helping in Africa. By August, images of the slaughter were being seen on TV, and in October, the UN Security Council finally acted, authorizing countries to provide assistance to stabilize the nation. Within 48 hours, the French sent 2,000 troops. No other country, not the U.S., did a thing. And 900,000 people were killed. That is a sin of omission. Okay. Tom Friedman talked about this, and he said, France acts like a great power but doesn't have the resources. The United States has the resources but doesn't act like a great power. And it's a very somber note to think of, but that thing could have been nipped in the bud. And that was a role of that U.S. could have done, and for political reasons, it wasn't. So on that somber note, I think we'll close. Thank you.